our speaking plans for silence is posted. Then we'll go to further and then finally at the UC Davis group where I was had the name in her face as a student. And he's here talking to us about that direction. And we'll be going forward in later at 5:45 meeting in the atrium, so anybody can watch.
Thank you, Constantinos. And then thank you for being here so early. When I came in and saw the type of seminar, I thought, how on earth is Constantinos going to take it? So this is a talk that I've chosen to be a little bit pretty broad, and so it deals with ideas. I find that it's good to start pretty broad, and it's sort of a coping style in some respects. So hopefully that makes it a little more accessible. Dark energy is tremendously, so the cosmic acceleration, which often is called dark energy for lack of better understanding, is a tremendously exciting topic. It certainly completely preoccupied me in recent years. And so I'll give an introduction. Part one is basically some ideas stimulated by cosmic acceleration, also just general thoughts about inflation that sort of tie in with this topic. And then part two, so the thing about dark energy is very, the cosmic acceleration is theoretically, we really don't know what's going on. That's my feeling. And that is very exciting. It stimulates lots of big ideas. But the thing I love about the topic is that not only does it stimulate sort of radical thinking, but it also is something that's experimentally driven, and we actually expect that in the future, there are concrete experiments we can do to learn more about the cosmic acceleration really should help us, really should have an impact on how we think about cosmic acceleration. And recently, over the last year or so, I've been completely preoccupied with my work on something called the Dark Energy Task Force, which is a group organized by the US funding agencies to chart of course for what kind of experiments we want to do in the future to get the best information we can on dark energy. So we've been doing a lot of calculations with that on that issue to find out what's best. And I'll pick, if there's time, depending on how much time there is at the end, I'll pick up on some of those points. So I don't know how much does this group need sort of comment about the fact that we observe cosmic acceleration? So is that a given here, or should I just skip these slides, or anyway, maybe just stop me, or go really fast and stop me if you want to. So here's a classic picture that we showed, where if you model the universe without, say, a cosmological constant, you'd be on this red line, and there's all this different data that puts you up here, something you simply couldn't understand without introducing something different. That in this case is the cosmological constant. The known matter that we see around us or in accelerators would put us somewhere around here. And so we have to add both dark matter on this axis and dark energy or something on this axis to fill out the picture. And when we work it out, we find that there's a tiny fraction of the observed universe stuff we actually know, and then a huge proportion of stuff we don't. Now, the thing about it, so the dark matter certainly makes this an exciting puzzle for fundamental physics, but the good news is that there are plenty of plausible candidates. So when we look at dark matter, we don't think, how on earth could nature possibly do this? We look at dark matter and we say, oh, well, there's a long list of possible candidates, and we go into these experiments, and hopefully we find out which of these ideas is right. And we don't have a feeling that we have to change everything to understand dark matter, although I still think it's pretty exciting to think that our understood matter that we know is a small fraction of the matter that's out there. For dark energy, there are many theories, certainly, but none are all that compelling. And the way I'd like to describe that is by applying an ego test. And so if someone comes up to you and is in your face and say, I'm really excited about my idea, I'm really excited about this idea for explaining the dark energy, explaining the cosmic acceleration, they're an author on the paper, guaranteed. The way we can tell if the field is progressing is if someone comes up and tells you, I'm really excited about this idea, and it's someone else's. That's when there's a real sense of progress. We're not really there yet. There's always some exceptions, but we're not really at that stage. So there's, depending on how you look at it, there's strange numbers associated with it. If you want to think of dark density and dark energy in Planck units, it's got this famous number, which if you want to write it as a mass scale to the fourth, has this tiny scale, or a lot of quintessence models maybe have a mass and a field where the field tends to have beds around the Planck scale, and then you need a mass with another strange value. So sort of depending, how you look at it, either way you cut it, there's things that at least superficially, numbers that are very strange, and you don't really know how you're going to produce those in your theoretical model. And then, and so it's a challenge, it poses a challenge that you have. There's something you've got to do be a little more clever than just sticking parameters because they have some strange values. And then the other issue is the relationship with the vacuum energy, which also contributes to the cosmological constant. And typically contributes 120 orders of magnitude more than you want. Maybe with supersymmetry, cut that down to 10 to the 60 or something, but it's still a problem. And it's also a problem because the sort of fantasy, theoreticians have known that this was an issue for a long time, and the fantasy that people have is that one of us will wake up in the shower one morning, realize there's some magical symmetry that gets rid of this altogether, and that's sort of the vision people have. But now it seems a little bit more complicated because there's something out there that's not zero. And it's behaving like that. And is it the vacuum energy? Is it something else that tends to sort of, at the very least, muddy those waters a little bit? So the issues, so sketching out the issues that sort of challenge this area. So where do these strange numbers come from? And if you have some idea, have you thought about quantum corrections to those numbers? They're tiny numbers. You can easily expect quantum corrections. Have you really thought that through? In a few cases, people have. Mostly, people haven't at all. Do I meet up fixed force issues? Apparently, yeah. So another issue is when you have such a light, if you're describing this with a scalar field, as many people do with these kind of mass scales, you just like having essentially massless field, which could lead to long-range forces. And so you have to be careful that your idea hasn't been ruled out already by fifth force experiments, which, again, most quintessence models out there, no one's paid any attention to that, although in some cases, anything worked that could help people, and then mosquitoes. People have. So there's a couple of different ideas out there where people have been a little bit more careful. Then you still are stuck with the question where you've sort of left this cosmological constant issue hanging. And if someone actually comes around and solves it, if you've been thinking about all this stuff, And then someone comes around and solves it, and I think this is related to the point that Quip was just taking over over coffee or juice this morning, is that someone can fix that, and then all of a sudden it can shift the whole territory for you, and so you wind up with a, you basically can shift the zero-point energy by a resolution of this problem. So how do you know that you've got the right idea until you've done that? Now, people also like to say there's a why now problem, because the acceleration is just starting at this epoch of the universe, the same epoch in which we happen to be living. That seems like some kind of tuning. But I'm a bit cranky about that point, because in most models of quintessence, including, or models of dark energy, including just choosing a cosmological constant, it's completely the same as this question. So it's not a separate question. In models of dark energy, so part of the reason for this is that for a cosmological constant, it's not a dynamic degree of freedom at all. If you do have dynamic degrees of freedom, many of the involved in this, many of the interesting models actually have attractive behavior, so they are independent of initial conditions. They lock into some kind of behavior that's determined by the parameters, and then that tells you exactly when they come to dominate. So it's not I'm not saying it's not a mystery, but it's a mystery that can be expressed in that, like point number one. And the only situation we might really add this as a separate point is when you also need to assume something about initial conditions for some dynamic system that is separate from the parameters in its equations of motion, and then you might have, that might feed into a separate why now problem. In many models, there is not one. So I think it's fair to say that most experts expect nothing short of a revolution is required to really fully understand how to integrate the cosmic acceleration with what we see, and that so integrate what we see in terms of cosmic acceleration with our theories of fundamental physics, and that's not happened yet, but there's some pretty interesting things happening along the way. So I described this era for one talk. I was trying to get pictures to go with the story. This is where I think we are now in terms of thinking about dark energy, at the stage of wild experimentation, rather than thinking we've got something solid and final to talk about. But I want to talk about a couple points that I find particularly exciting, especially for cosmology. We can start out just with the notion of cosmic living. So an interesting property of some types of dark energy, certainly including simply having a cosmological constant, is the formation of an event horizon. And we know event horizons from black holes, and the basic picture, the important takeaway message of that is that if you're standing outside a black hole, you never see something fall through the horizon. And if you have a cosmological constant or something sufficiently close to that, you have a similar thing going on. So the late times in cosmology approaches the center space, and that also has a horizon, except it's sort of inside out. And you're sitting there in this exponentially expanding background. As an object, if you throw an object, you'll see it approach the horizon, but sort of redshift toward it, and it'll be much like something that you throw into a black hole, and you'll never see it go out. Now, this has a very interesting aspect of this is you stop and think, what do you mean by equilibrium? One way to think about equilibrium is it's what happens to a system. You just leave it for a long time. And so if a system is able to achieve equilibrium, you can just define it as where it goes, and just leave it there and wait and see what happens. And if you do that as a universe with a cosmological constant that approaches this de-Sitter space. And it's a uniform state. Classically, it's completely empty, just has a cosmological constant. But with quantum effects, Gibbs Hawking argued that that's a Hawking temperature, very low Hawking temperature. And you can think of this as, and also argue that it has an area. It has an entropy defined in terms of area in the usual way, the area of the horizon. And you can think of that, why not think of that as an equilibrium state for the universe? It's sort of an actual description of the heat death for the universe when we approach the state asymptotically. So is this a picture of the ultimate equilibrium state for the universe? One thing I just have to, I find so intriguing, I have to sort of stick in at this point, is that, well, one of the points that we will be using a lot is that from this point of view, there's a maximum entropy of the system, which is when you actually approach the de-Sitter space. So one of the contributions in this original paper by Gibbons and Hawking was to show that if you put a black hole into the de-Sitter space, the entropy actually goes down. And so you put a black hole in, or which means presumably or any other little object, it'll eventually decay and reach the de-Sitter space, and that will be the maximum entropy state. And so one question that Banks and Fischler ask is, if you have a system with a maximum entropy, one point that I haven't actually listed on the slide here is that you can ask the question if you will never see something go through the horizon, if you're sitting in the de-Sitter space, is there any meaning at all to talk about outside of that horizon? Does that horizon define the entire universe? And there's people who argue, a number of people, including Banks and Fischler, Susskind, and a few others, who at least sometimes in their careers argued that maybe the right thing to do is to say that's the entire physical world. The physical world that describes the causal path which you see, an observer sees, and there's nothing else outside it. And that causal path has a maximum entropy state, which is the center space. And if you think, one of the interesting offshoots of that is if you think about entropy as being related to the logarithm of the number of states, you can ask, should your system, should your fundamental laws of physics only have a finite number of states? Because in some sense, why would you need more? Is adding more than this number of states related to the maximum entropy, is adding more than that number of states just metaphysics? Are you adding things you simply can't ever observe and can't ever need to describe?
So isn't the causal patch is much bigger than the Hubble patch? And you're using for the entropy proportional to area, proportional to S to the power minus 2. So what's the logic going on there?
Well, what am I doing? So what are
entropy? Yeah.
No, this is the entropy that you can see.
So
that.
Entropy of what? I mean, entropy of
the what you see, the entropy of what you actually see.
But in principle, I have my Gaussian patch, which is much bigger than the Hubble patch, and I see much bigger patch than the Hubble patch. Do you see anything?
So, that's you don't know you're seeing that. You might try to rework your description of that, where there's a finite system, and you couldn't. You don't know the stuff you see. Mm-hmm. You don't know if it's boiling off the horizon, off of the thermal scale on the horizon.
Okay, if I take their point of view that Kobe has seen fluctuations on scales larger than the size of the Hubble patch at the time of CMB formation, and if I take that point of view, then
that's a different larger than the Hubble patch at the time.
Yeah.
No, we're talking about H today.
So you're talking about just the Hubble entropy contained in the Hubble patch.
No, in fact, not even today. I'm talking about tomorrow when we're really in the de-Sitter space. So So I'm just talking about that one number, the age selection, maybe right, yeah, I mean, it's the age, it's the fundamental lambda, not some earlier. Does that answer your question?
Well, if I believe in inflationary cosmology, then my whole point is that causal path is much bigger than the Hubble path.
Well, let me get a little, I think we'll get closer to talking about that as the talk goes on. But definitely, we can carry on with that discussion. I think we'll get closer, but I don't think we'll have a definitive answer because there's different assumptions you can make. I'll say some interesting things about that.
Okay.
Whether you'll be satisfied, I don't know. I'm not sure I know. To me, that's one of the sort of. So basically, the issue is how do you think about inflation? How do you. So there's a lot of. Here's a statement I'll make. I find this incredibly funny. I find that these arguments really appeal in a certain way. But all my life, I've thought about inflation in more classical terms, not in these terms. And I thought about inflation where you think about the universe as much, much, much exponentially larger than one Hubble patch now or in the future. And so I actually found, when I started thinking about this, I actually found it claustrophobic. I really felt very difficult to fit my ideas about the universe into this kind of picture. But I think formally it's possible. You can ask a given question, and you can talk about how it would have to be answered in this picture. And it does involve assuming some fancy quantum gravity things are happening at the horizon to sort of seal things off. Now, we don't have a theory that does that, so you sort of have to imagine what might be happening. But you can at least say words. You can sort of talk through the way things must work. And then you can decide if you find that satisfying or not. So now I want to talk a little bit about if you possibly can have such an equilibrium state, what it might mean for cosmology. And I want to step back and just talk about how do we think about initial conditions in cosmology? Because that's a topic. I actually find it interesting that before inflation, there was a small community that worried about small numbers puzzles in the Big Bang and so on. But in most of physics, you never think about initial conditions. You use them. If you're a theorist and you're comparing your theory to something going on in the laboratory, well, you might sort of hang out with experimentalists and talk about what's the best setup, what's the best experimental setup to test the theory. So you use initial conditions as a tool to sort of leverage your activities in the laboratory and test your theory. But you never get into sort of deep philosophical questions about initial conditions. But in cosmology, there's a lot that rides on understanding initial conditions, and people do get all tangled up with different arguments about how to think about initial conditions. And when I say initial conditions, I really mean sort of the explaining the state of the FRW universe we observe at early times, which may or may not be the bottom line for the universe, because there may be extra dimensions and all that, but I'm really just talking about initial conditions from a sort of local sense for us. And one thing you can do is simply state what the initial conditions must be. And seems like a negative comment if you're playing God, but actually there's also a very positive way to put this, which is if you're stating what they must be, you're just reverse engineering. So in this sense, there's sort of two sides. One side is you can say, we just reverse engineer. You say, we have the Friedman equations, we have some idea of what the matter in the universe is, and you just extrapolate back, and you say the Big Bang started in this state, and then the Big Bang theory fits the data, and we're done. And we don't have to worry about it. We just should be glad we found one possible initial condition that fits the observations. And then we don't worry about why it might be tuned or not, because it's just our universe, that's the way it is. And so in that way, we're not really playing God, we're just being kind of business-like physicists, just like people would be comparing their theory with something in the laboratory. But also, the other thing that happens is physicists get into pompous arguments but why their theory of initiative, you know, I have a theory that the initiative missions should be one way or another, and I find, you know, that's what I call finding God, because it just seems empty. Like when people just make these arguments based on principles. The other idea that I find very attractive is to have, if you can have some theory of the universe where you let possible initial states for the FRW universe be observed, compete with each other in some concrete way, and then the most probable way to realize the FRW universe, so to see, the idea is you have some way of attaching probabilities to an FRW universe within certain initial conditions, and then the most probable is actually what you claim to predict in cosmology. And of course, that means you need a scheme for assigning probabilities. If you're not careful, you're right back to here. Because if your scheme is ad hoc, then it's just what you put in is what you get out. So the only way out of this situation that I have ever heard of is if you can argue that the universe is basically in equilibrium, because in equilibrium, nature, at least in principle, tells you how to assign probabilities to different fluctuations. So the idea now is that if we think about a universe that's in equilibrium, and cosmology is actually a theory of fluctuations out of equilibrium, then in principle, you have a concrete way to compute probabilities for different fluctuations. And those probabilities are given to you by the laws of physics, not by some ad hoc argument you put in. So I find that very appealing, because here you are, and here's the universe, and I just don't think, you know, if I can get an argument, you know, every now and then there's even these sort of flame wars on the astro pH, you know, my theory of initial conditions is better than yours, because it, I don't know, looks more like scattering theory, or it looks more like I've done the micro rotation this way or that way. I don't see why the universe has to listen to that stuff. Whereas if it's equilibrium based on the fundamental laws of physics, then the universe is listening to itself, and it makes a lot more sense. Yeah.
So I'm confused, because I think that you've argued that the equilibrium would be at the end of the universe, but you seem to need it at the beginning.
Right. So let me, that's all. So I'll show you later. When physicists think about, so my dad was a chemist, and he teased me. When I think about, he'd say, you know, when you think about molecules, you really think about atoms, aren't you? And I'd say, yeah, I actually think about the hydrogen atom. So that's as far as I go. When physicists think about equilibrium systems, they're always thinking about a box of gas to start with. So I'm going to give an analogy with the box of gas before talking about the way I think it would go in cosmology. And so the box of gas, and this is actually, you know, it goes back to Boltzmann, as a lot of things do. And he actually apparently thought a little bit about what this might mean for cosmology. But if you have a box of gas, it will approach equilibrium and then pretty much sit there. And if you wait long enough, there will be very rare, there will be small fluctuations all the time. And if you wait long enough, there will be a rare fluctuation. And if you look at a rare fluctuation, so one of the things you can ask about is the arrow of time. So the arrow of time is associated with increasing entropy. Most of the times you're watching this thing just sit here, you're in maximum entropy. There is no arrow of time, the entropy is just constant, basically. And in fact, you have no way of, you know, if you showed a movie of the equilibrium state and you cut it up and reassembled it in some random way, it would look just as good. But during this rare fluctuation, you can't chop up the movie and re-show it, and there is an arrow of time. And actually, the curious thing is that there's two arrows of time that work back to back from the low entropy, the most low entropy part of this fluctuation. So if you look at the system and say, well, where, you know, if I live in this thing, if I live here, I think the arrow of time is going this way for high entropy. If I live here, I think the arrow of time is going this way for low entropy. And the only situations where I have an arrow of time are during fluctuations the rest of the time. I'm just sitting there. And of course, That means most of the time the universe doesn't have narrow time, if you're in this picture. And then there are time. So Lenny Susskind has a comment that our idea that the second law is absolute is temporal provincialism, this picture. We see it around us, but we don't. But in this picture, it's a very rare feature of the universe. And to me, actually, the arrow of time is something I'm not very fond of. I'm very cautious about anthropic arguments. But to me, it seems that the arrow of time is something that makes a lot of sense to argue in an anthropic way, because there's absolutely no basis otherwise. I mean, you just have to, you put it in as an initial condition, just by hand, or say that we're part of a larger system. We certainly need that our time to exist, so it will naturally evolve only during these very fluctuations. Yeah.
I agree that if you're in these two boxes, you won't be able to tell the difference. But isn't that because there is no structure on your red blobs? In a realistic system, each one of those would also be a thermodynamical system. So then what if you're sitting on that one and you can see the entropy increasing on every single little red blob around you, but the collection of those has a decreasing entropy? So you'll be able to tell that you're going the wrong way.
So if I'm in this inner space at late times, what are those? So you're saying that somewhere in those blobs I have a notebook, so I keep notes, or I can take a movie.
Each one of those blobs also satisfies the thermodynamic. It's actually a composite system in reality. So I would be living in this universe, and I would see the second law of thermodynamics affecting every single physical system, every star, every person, whatever, every room. But then the whole thing altogether seems to be going the wrong way.
Well, isn't this violation of the second law of thermodynamics? My total entropy should always increase. And what you're talking is the subsystems. You have some n number of subsystems. So my total entropy should always increase.
No, but this does, in StatMech, the entropy goes down as often as it goes up. So the second law only derives from a choice of initial conditions where entropy is low.
Choice of subsystem, not the initial condition.
So you have to. I'm treating the universe as a closed system. So, but I'm treating the universe as a closed system, so that's my subsystem. But that's what I would do. So one of the features of this picture is that the universe is a harmonic closed system. If you accept this idea that this sort of causal patch argument. And that's one of the points. So there's a paper by Dyson et al, which is the first paper on this, and they very carefully make the point that if this is a closed system, it's has a finite dimensional Hilbert. They argue it's finite dimensional Hilbert space, and there's recurrences.
Okay, so you're saying it's a kind of like pure state.
Yeah,
the whole system is a pure state. But I mean, I don't care the whole state. I care about what my system, subsystem is.
Sure.
Because I'm measuring here.
But I'm just cosmologist, I'm doing the whole thing. So we sit here and we approach the series. Yeah. What happens to these subsystems of yours? They just get boiled up on the horizon.
My thermal physics is operating in my Hubble patch. So,
right. What happens? So describe the scenario. So you're sitting there. So tell me some scenario. I don't believe what you're saying is true. But I believe that you will approach heat death and everything will die. Everything will hit maximum entropy in the desiderata, and then you wait around for large fluctuation.
If you treat the universe as a closed system, it's a pure state. You cannot talk about entropy in that sense.
Sure, I can.
You can?
Sure, I can.
You can?
Yeah. I can explain and talk about subsystems, and I'm in business. I mean, a box of gas can be a pure state. I can certainly talk about entropy by coarse-grainy, which means I just admit the fact that I am not an observer.
I agree with your first thing. So that when you coarse-grain, it means that you're defining a system as a kind of like bunch of subsystems.
Right.
And you're saying that I'm living in a subsystem and I'm observing whatever.
But that doesn't stop me from having a heat death if the whole system is finite. And that's what you get with the desiderate space. And that's what I described here in the box of gas, which is also finite. So this is the heuristic picture, and this is the only way. So the idea is that cosmology is waiting for these rare fluctuations, and then physics assigns its own probabilities to these different kinds of fluctuations. So cosmology, so the idea is that then if I'm here, this is my Big Bang. I look back and this is sort of the beginning of everything in some sense. And it's the physical system that is assigning probabilities to that event happening one way or another. And I can, in principle, calculate this. So here's the sort of realization. So the concept of the equilibrium state is that the sitter space, which I'm drawing in this here's the gray, I'm sort of describing kind of spread the horizon. The rare fluctuation is something, the thermal state of the sitter space fluctuating into some kind of excitation, which I've prejudiced here by suggesting might be a localized fluctuation, which isn't a terrible thing, way to think about it. And that's the rare fluctuation that I'm talking about for cosmology. Now, there's this subject which I call Boltzmann's brain problem, and it's something, so Boltzmann actually tried to think about cosmology in a sense. He didn't really think about gravity, and he thought more in terms of conventional equilibrium systems without long-range forces. And story has it that he thought through this particular issue, although I get to find the references. I think there are good references to the fact that he thought, in this picture, the arrow prime just comes from waiting for the rare fluctuation. But this issue, the first reference I have to it is from Feynman, but he seems to act like people knew that, like it wasn't his invention, which is really something. I mean, really must not have been his invention if he took that tone. But here's the Boltzmann's brain paradox. If your picture of the universe is fundamentally an equilibrium system undergoing fluctuations periodically to give you temporary arrows of time, then the most likely fluctuation, so then you start thinking, well, how do you assign probabilities to different things? And the most likely fluctuation consistent with everything you know is your world, and technically actually just your brain, fluctuating out of chaos. And so your brain, complete with false memories of all the Hubble field and the Kobe map and all of that, fluctuating out of chaos and then being immediately destroyed by returning to equilibrium. So I was telling Jim Peebles about this. He said, oh yeah, that's the everything you know is wrong picture, which is fair enough. And this is actually a problem in principle with thinking about the universe this way. And inflation, and people sort of thought about this and then kind of backed off worrying about it. First of all, because no one knew what to do with it, and also because it wasn't at all clear how you could think of, once you thought about gravity, how you could think about an equilibrium state for the universe. And it's only through the observation of the cosmic acceleration and the sort of, it's causing us to think more seriously about the possibility of a fundamental cosmological constant that brings us now back to thinking that way about it. And so it really is a problem, although a lot of people haven't really been thinking about that. And inflation is the only possible answer that I know of to this idea, because with inflation, you have a chance, and you can show that these sort of estimates could come out. And it's sort of hard to be sure exactly you're getting rough numbers, but you can make sense that with inflation, you have a small, but the idea of inflation is it takes a small fluctuation of an inflaton in just some small region to start inflation going. And it's possible then to have a small fluctuation that's very cheap and entropically, cheaper than producing one grain. You sort of need about a few grams to start inflation, sort of occupy a few grams of the system to start inflation. That can be cheap. So then the cost per brain or per planet, I don't think I understand brains and consciousness too well to include it in the physical just planets as a standard. You produce so many of them for the one equation, but the entropic cost per planet is actually cheaper with inflation. So if you have inflation, then you produce, expand out and produce a large system in the state, in the FRW state, you get lots of planets. And so I believe this is, as you'll see, in the end, I think this could end up being regarded as at least as important as the other more traditionally discussed successes of inflation. So, but there's two versions of this story. So version one is kind of what I was just saying. The initial fluctuation that starts inflation is a small perturbation on the equilibrium state. So there's a few small number of all the degrees of freedom get tied up, pushing the inflaton up potential, and thus it's very cheap. And that way, calculations, and I'll show you roughly how that goes in a minute, that show that inflation is a much more likely way than fluctuating into the whole universe directly. And then, under these conditions, you really do solve the Boltzmann's ring problem, and you actually have predictive power. You're saying, actually, the preferred fluctuation to give us what we see comes packaged with inflation, which comes packaged with a spectrum of perturbations, flattening, and so on, that are the predictions we commonly believe come from inflation. Version two, however, and this is a different calculation, different way of calculating, says that initial fluctuations in star inflation are actually more expensive than the universe, or even just the brain fluctuating directly. And it turns out, in this picture, can even disfavor the Big Bang, as opposed to other more junky pictures.
I'm thinking about something very naive. So if you bring in inflation in your picture, because you have in mind that you're thinking of the scissors space and the cosmological constant today's value, and you want to say somehow there's going to be a small fluctuation inside, which is then going into the inflation. But then what happens with eternal inflation, right? People will say, if you have inflation, then you have eternal inflation. And then your space globally really looks like a scissor space with that very high cosmological
quantum. Right. So the claim has to be in that picture that the fundamental physics is just the degrees of freedom that describe our Hubble bomb, or a little bit bigger. And that now the only way we know how to describe it is sort of the field theories of gravity that extend way beyond our Hubble bomb. So there has to be some quantum gravity thing that steps in to shut down, to sort of cut off that picture, and that thing that cuts off the picture there must also cut off eternal inflation. So it must not be possible to have eternal inflation repeat and repeat and repeat, because you don't have enough degrees of freedom to produce all that volume. That's a classical picture that would have to be changed. And this is where this picture is completely hand-waving, because you're just like people who wanted to have the thick horizon, and you throw something in, and there's no inside the black hole from the external point of view, and then you jump in, and all those degrees of freedom start to rearrange themselves to make a different world for that observer. No one knows that. That's just talk, right? And so you need to have the same kind of talk to talk your way out of eternal inflation. And it's an interesting question how that would really work. But for this scenario, you have to stop people from thinking about eternal inflation in the normal way. And you have to appeal to some magic quantum gravity thing, the same thing that closes off the universe, to also do that.
And so quantum gravity or the back reaction effect? Because the fluctuation is as small anyway. Why would I expect the quantum gravity effect to shut off the eternal inflation?
Well, I don't know. Why would I not call it quantum gravity? I don't know. It's whatever shuts off. So this is all. This is ruled out because So there's sort of different papers, and I want to give you. Can I write on one of these boards? Can everyone see? Okay. without the things, you know. So let me sketch the basis of these two different pictures. It's very, really very simple. So if you have a sitter space and it has some entropy associated with the cosmological constant that goes with it, if you add a little perturbation in it, with far away from the perturbation, it should look towards you if it's a small perturbation. That's because that's how a localized object would look at a distance. You don't have to assume it's a black hole. But it would look towards you and would have an associated entropy that would be black hole entropy. It's really just a function, just whatever function of the mass. It's really expressing the mass. And it turns out that when you introduce a small perturbation, the horizon gets modified. So the horizon, the area of horizon associated with the sitter space gets modified in this way. There's a geometric mean that comes in, where this is just the effective area of that this mass would have in the black hole. But all you're really using is this little short you from far away. And so the entropy is the same thing, where there's an effective entropy for the perturbation. And so that picture, you can see that you can have a small perturbation, and you can have a small, the smaller the perturbation, the more likely it is, because you're looking at small perturbations, small entropy. So let me just add, the point that you're saying that the probability of, so if you're comparing, let's say the probability for a different perturbation to occur is just the perturbed entropy, for the entropy of the whole system under the perturbation versus the entropy of the, so this is the number of states consistent with that fluctuation divided by the number of states in the whole system, which is a even total. And so you can see that this is equal to this is a perturbation that becomes more likely as the entropy of that for small fluctuations, because small fluctuations are perturbing the total entropy in a small way. So it fits with your intuitive picture that if you ask what's the probability of a small fluctuation in a large system, the smaller the fluctuation, more likely it is to happen. Now then, this collaboration, Dyson et al., think a very different way about the same process. And so, just to be clear, we're talking about some small fluctuation, which is basically an inflaton getting pushed up on its potential to start the process of inflation. And the way, so this is the way I thought about it with Lorenzo Sorbo, and we wrote a paper about it. But this is really using ideas that have been in the literature a long time and putting them together in this particular way. And then Dyson et al. Thought about this in a very different way. And so DKS say that during inflation, there's also a horizon. It looks like a sitter space. And they said, we insist, based on these principles of causal patch physics, that for an observer during inflation, that an entropy of the entire universe is given by the horizon area of the quasi de Sitter space during inflation. And so DKS say that the entropy of the universe during inflation is equal to it's just proportional to the area during inflation, which is about 10 to the 10 for gut scale inflation, which is, in the grand scheme of things, a very small number. This S lambda this tend to be 120. And what they argue is that, so they say the probability of inflation goes as e to the 10 to the 10, whereas the probability of the standard Big Bang, which they also calculate in a similar way, is the standard Big Bang, even in early times, is much higher entropy than this, because entropy about 10 to the 85 or so. So is much more, much more probable than the probability of inflation. So they're basically using ideas about horizons so the critical point here is that, and then this is really, so this picture up here is just rephrasing in a very slightly more technical way, it's still pretty handling, but the intuition people have, people who feel comfortable with inflation, that it somehow makes sense as a resolution of cosmological problems and explanation of initial conditions, tend to feel, well, gee, this is great, there's some tiny little fluctuation, maybe it's rare, it doesn't have to be such a big fluctuation, it gets the universe hooked into exponential expansion, it creates these huge regions that look like the universe we observe. That is intuitively, a lot of people feel that must be a very cheap fluctuation that you can realize. But that seems to make sense as an explanation for how the universe got to be the way it did. And this is a calculation that gets you there. It gets you to that result. But PK has to come along and say, no, that's wrong. To start inflation, you're not just asking for some little piece of the whole system to fluctuate into a certain state. You're causing the whole system to condense out. So all the degrees of freedom you used to describe this equilibrium state have to condense out into a state with a very tiny entropy by comparison. And these are arguments they make based on how they like to think about horizons and causal patterns and so on. And this is, I find this is much more in keeping, this argument is much more in keeping with conventional ideas about fluctuations in an equilibrium system, but I find the arguments behind this point very interesting. If you look at our paper, we take pains not to dismiss it. We're making the argument there's another way to think about it, but I still find this very interesting. I'm not completely sure. I mean, if I were a little bit more arrogant, I'd say, well, look, this supports standard cosmology, which works incredibly well for the observations, so this got to be right. But I think we're not close enough to understanding this on a more concrete level to sort of make that kind of claim. But that's the sort of basic difference between the two. So here's my message to myself. Discuss the calculations on the board. Now,
so can you rephrase what you just said in the same in the same variable? So basically, what is the probability if I have the universe?
So you want to see the same numbers?
Right, it's the same formula for the probability for the.
So this is
10-120. No, not the formula. I want the formula. E to the some of the analogous things that you wrote.
Or down here.
Right.
So I wrote this, and you want to see what I write down here?
Is the probability. Now we can exactly.
So I should have written this. So if I say this is the, if I say the, so that means the probability for inflation is e minus square root less lambda less inflation. So whatever fluctuation starts inflation, it gives you that. Now we have two expressions for any inflation.
That's sort of your approximation for the Schwarzschild level.
Yeah.
As a heap. Okay.
Yeah. And so that's, and actually, when you get technical about this, when you look at exactly what kind of fluctuations you think about, it's not even clear that this has to be very large at all. It might even, it's sort of a zero entropy limit from the outside. And that's a very interesting technical question. I'm not sure I believe we get to take that limit completely, but some people do. So this is not, if you scrutinize it deeply, there's lots of sort of loose ends and issues to think about, but this is the rough
This is a rough picture.
And at the bottom, what?
And so at the bottom, we have, so we could, the thing to compare is this number versus this number. And so, wait, let me be going. The thing we should compare, actually, is the probability of creating a big bang versus on its own versus the probability of creating inflation in each of these cases. So if you want to get tempted to roll the screen up, is that fast enough? Or can,
this is as important as the
grid.
Actually, why don't we continue afterwards, since I noticed the time. I actually don't think I'm going to get... So when should I stop? Now? 5 minutes? Okay. So let's see where we go with this. So the version one requires a small fluctuation out of the thermal bath, basically, to get started. And it's much easier to start inflation than start holding bang directly. And version two is because of horizon issues, there is no bath. And so the entropy of the entire universe must reduce down 10 to 10. And it's much more expensive than going directly to the big bang, which has a larger entropy. So one of the important points. So some of the responses people have to this issue. So just to be clear, Dice, Clevin, and Susskind, I forget the exact title of the paper, but it's basically they say this is a problem of having a fundamental cosmological constant. They believe enough in cosmology that at the end of the day, they say you can't possibly have a fundamental cosmological constant because that leads to this problem. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I do have a very naive question about the first part.
Mm-hmm.
I agree that your small fluctuation is much less, to start inflation is much less costly than trying to start the Big Bang.
Okay.
Because the Big Bang is a lower entropy.
Well, it's right. The whole system has a lower entropy.
That's right. So that
fluctuation
is more costly.
More expensive, right.
But is it obvious that that fluctuation to start inflation is less costly than just starting from the center space and popping out into the current state of the universe? Because today's entropy is not too different from S lambda.
Oh, it is. It's maybe 10 to 9 years, I think, but it's much higher than them. So the entropy of the universe today, 1085 is like the early universe, and 10 to 90 or something is today with black holes, counting black holes at the center of galaxies. But it's still very small. So we'd have to be in a giant black hole. All the matter in the universe would have to be in a black hole to achieve 1020. So we're down. The universe is still very low entropy. That's maybe because we're not in the center space here. So,
I thought it's not the wisdom entropy of the center space.
Of the center space, but we're not in the center space. So we're in the lower state. Lower.
So the answer is it's much more like, much more probable to fluctuate.
Yeah, inflation. Right. Okay. So the entropy in the universe today, if you just count up radiation of black holes, it's 10 to the 90 or something, maybe 10 to 95.
Just to clarify, so when you said that here is 10 to 10 during inflation, it means it's just the initial Hubble batch.
Yeah, that's the batch. You just plug in the gut scale. And was there another question? So a lot of people react. So if you talk with Alan Luke about this stuff, he says, why do we even think about initial conditions for inflation? There's eternal inflation. Eternal inflation tells me that I'm most likely, it doesn't matter how improbable it is to start inflation, you just wait long enough and you have all this inflation and you have this huge volume of the universe, you have so much volume that it doesn't matter how low the probability is. Surely the volume wins in the end with eternal inflation, and you don't have to think about it. And that's wrong in this picture. This is the right picture. Starting inflation means you have put a system in an entropy with 10 to the 10, then if you have enough degrees of freedom in your system to really have internal inflation, it's even worse for you to fluctuate into inflation because you can, you basically, to have, I mean, in this issue, truncating entropy of the universe to 10 to 120 makes life easier for fluctuations than if you had to reduce the entropy of the whole universe to 10 to the 10 of a much larger system. And the same is true with the string theory landscape. So Lenny seems to, my feeling is that Lenny seems to have been attracted partly to the string theory landscape because it seemed to offer a way out of this calculation phase, because the cosmological constant is no longer fundamental. And you simply say, well, these arguments just don't go through. You don't have recurrences. You can't argue that. But the most important part of that, is that you stop thinking in a fundamental way about the state of the universe and then how you do cosmology. You just sort of throw up your hands and say, well, we're somehow, you know, cascading through the system, but we don't know why we started in the third place, and we don't know why we're in one state rather than another, except by some local arguments. So again, if it really costs you this much to start to have inflation, and your whole string theory landscape has to enter into the state of that entropy, that's also going to be a strong suppression. So I don't see how this really, it evades the problem by making it seem much too complicated to think about, but I don't think it fundamentally makes me more confident that the problem is resolved in these pictures. It seems just that in both these cases, if you really think this is what you have to do to start inflation, then you're really in trouble in these pictures as well, even though it's harder to put numbers on things.
But DKS also required that inflation is past the tunnel, isn't it?
No,
if it's not past the tunnel, then I'm not allowed to reconcile.
Reconcile with what?
I mean, if it's not past the tunnel, then how can I?
You can't do it classically. There's some quantum aspect to it, which is the known. So I'm just commenting. You know, these guys talk about creating a universe in the garage, and then it has to be quantum, and I'm just sort of referring to this earlier work. They worried about whether the path integrals were well defined. These guys did it in the Hamiltonian formalism, which is what we use to try to emphasize that it can be a little bit more concrete. You don't have to worry too much about path integral issues. You can phrase it in concrete terms. And there's various other interesting papers that are related to this issue. One thing I find particularly interesting is a recent paper by Geary and Johnson, who actually described these two processes. Instead of waving your hands about entropy and horizons, you can just see this as two different saddle point tunneling probabilities for entering inflation. And so I think I wish I had time to really digest this paper carefully, but if you're trying to understand which you believe, maybe a way to think about that is to look very closely at this paper and see if there's some reason why so basically, if you want to believe version two, so this is a much more likely fluctuation. They describe a situation where using the methods really of these collaborators, they show sort of semi-classical tunneling pictures that describe both of these fluctuations. Since this one dominates, their conclusion would be that this is the right picture, except even they are kind of have these reasons why they kind of favor Susskind's picture. But then they have to, then you have to find some reason why you don't believe one of those semi-classical channels. And they don't have a good reason. So if you want to think about this in more concrete terms, you can read this paper and ask, is one of these tunneling channels wrong for some reason? That could be an interesting way to go. My conclusion for this part is just, again, going back to taking the fundamental cosmological seriously suggests radical changes how we think about physics and cosmology. Gives, I think, the first time ever the possibility to think about equilibrium cosmology, which I really think is our only chance. I think if we don't get to do equilibrium cosmology, let the laws of physics calculate their own probabilities for us, then there's really no hope of understanding initial conditions in cosmology. And we just might as well just stick with FRW and say, needs our initial conditions. That's my view. And then depending on what I think could be pretty deep unresolved questions about which of these pictures is right, the equilibrium cosmology either helps us put the status quo on a stronger footing or really sends us back to the drawing board if version two of this picture is correct. Now, I think maybe this, given the time, we skip probing dark energy. Maybe I'll just tell you that my activities over the last several months have been really tied up with technical calculations of what different data sets could do to tell us different future, possible future data sets could do to tell us more about dark energy. Maybe I'll just leave it with one comment about the dark energy task force, which I've been working with. And that our report is all, in another couple months, the report will be up. But the key points, we've already released some information. We've chosen a quantitative figure of merit to compare experiments. We can make order of magnitude progress, but you can't do it just, for example, with supernovae or just with Arian oscillations. There's incredible power actually in mixing different types of data, and we're starting to understand that in a very technical way. There's interesting correlations in parameter space that allow you to get a lot of leverage from the different kinds of data. And you really need to go, one of the questions was, are there simple, quick projects that allow you to get very far with dark energy? And you can get a little bit with the sort of medium-term projects, but these major projects like JDEM or LST are required to really make serious progress. And then one interesting offshoot is that part of what happens, and actually part of why it helps to combine data, is that the data you sort of designed thinking about dark energy meets extremely tight constraints on other cosmological parameters. So in that sense, we're really, if we build these things, we're going to enter an era of really high precision cosmology. And so that's pretty interesting as well. So my overall conclusions are, I didn't wait around for Science Magazine to tell me this, but even Science Magazine has labeled the issue of combined dark matter and dark energy is the number one question in science of our era. I agree with that for sure. And they call out especially dark energy as the most mysterious of all. I believe a revolution is needed to understand it. I think some of the ideas I've been talking about today are certainly revolutionary. They may be the wrong ones. But I find it very exciting to think about all the things that could be there waiting for us to understand this. That's all driving interesting ideas. And the wonderful thing, I think, it's fun to talk about ideas, but to me it's really exciting to think that along with the ideas comes the rigor, the promise of new data that will really pin us down in the future. Thanks.
Lots of questions.